The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Geek Vibes Live is rated G for geek.
Hey, this is Matt Lesher.
This is Phil Lamar.
Hey, this is Rodney Taylor, a.k.a. the Penguin from Gotham, and you are listening to Geek Vibes Live.
Hey, Bubs, this is Cal Dodd. You're now listening to Geek Vibes Live.
Hello, how is everyone doing this wonderful afternoon? This Thursday, at least in Georgia, rainy afternoon. Hope everyone's having a great time. I am your host for this wonderful interview with Geek Vibes Nation on Geek Vibes Live, of course. I'm Dana Alves. You might know me from the movie show Geek Vibes Live and the wrestling show that was on last night. New episode of Wrestling Geeks Alliance premiered last night at 8 o'clock. I'll have it back, guys, 7 o'clock like I normally do. Just me going solo, but, you know, next week we'll have the full crew, and definitely check out Geek Vibes Live over on Sunday nights. We drop that at 8 o'clock. Talk about the greatest things within film and geek-related film, you know, comic book genre stuff, if you will. So this interview is going to be great, just waiting for our wonderful guest to come on. And I guess before he gets here, let me go over a couple plugs. If you guys are new to it, we'd love you to be a part of GV Nation, Geek Vibes Nation, if you will. To do so or get more, you know, interacting with, go to our website, gvnation.com. That's GV as in Geek Vibes, nation.com. And that will have links to all of our news articles that we have coming out that our wonderful writers spend a lot of time, you know, dropping new stuff, working on, you know, their own think pieces, if you will. We also have links to our iTunes. We have links to pretty much every form of media within Facebook, you know, Blog Talk, obviously, with this, Twitter, Instagram. So check that out. We'd really appreciate it. Join Geek Vibes Nation on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram. And I'll kind of fill you guys in on who we're waiting for. The awesome actor by the name of Stuart Stone. I mean, this guy is going to be a lot of fun for me personally to talk about because he's a man of many trades. You see, he understands different forms of geekdom. He's a big fan. He's an actor. He's a voice actor. He's a rapper. He's somewhat of a professional wrestler. And all that type of stuff is near, dear to my heart. So as soon as Stuart calls in, we will add him, and we will have a lovely interview with him. Hope, like I said, everyone's doing good out there. I'm just, you know, basically I'm trying to kill time. So maybe I can do some audio cues. Let's see. But which ones do we have right now? This one's fun.
And that's the bottom line. Just don't go sesso.
Well, I think that was appropriate because I'm pretty sure that we have our guest on hold. So let me introduce our guest. Our guest today is a film, television, and voice actor, director, and also producer of television, film, and music. In film, he is best known for his roles in Donnie Darko and The Boys Club, as well as voice work for childhood cartoons that I and you watched, like The Magic School Bus, X-Men Animated Series, and The Adventures of Super Mario Brothers. He also has toured as both a successful comedian and rapper. Geek Vibes Nation, give it up for Stuart Stone. How are you doing today, Stu?
Pretty good, man. How you doing? Thanks for giving it up.
Not a problem at all, man.
What an introduction. Very nice.
Hey, I do what I can, man. You have quite a list of interests, professions, and accomplishments. Quite a renaissance, man.
Thanks, man. You know, you gotta have quite the hat collection these days if you want to make it in this world.
Absolutely. I feel like we are kindred spirits on our passions of geekdom, if you will. I'm also into comics, professional wrestling, film, animation, big music buff and hip-hop buff, love comedy and stand-up comedy, and I love horror movies. So I'm very excited to talk to you.
Sounds like it's a match, man. Swipe right.
Oh, man. That's funny. All right. But, yeah, so I want to talk, start off with asking you about your role in a movie that I watched, Stu, 2001. So that's when I was a freshman in high school. At an age, basically, where I was going from the whole kid to adult teen mode, and I watched a movie called Donnie Darko, in which you play the role of Ronald Fisher. All of my friends watched it. It blew my mind. I think it was before I fucking started taking drugs and shit back then. It still just completely bewildered me. What is it like to be a part of a cult classic like that?
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine how lucky of a person you have to be to, you know, to be able to be a part of a project like that. And, you know, when we were making that movie, we certainly, you know, we didn't know that it was going to be what it was. And, you know, when we saw the movie for the first time, you know, much like a lot of people out there, we were like scratching our heads like, what the fuck is this? And the fact that so many people, you know, just gravitated towards the film, it's just incredible. Like when it first came out in the theater, it bombed. Like it was a complete bust. And it wasn't until after the movie came out on, you know, DVD and at Blockbuster and stuff like that, people really started gravitating to the movie so much so that it ended up becoming so popular and making so much money on that market that they ended up re-releasing it in theaters 2 years later, and it had like a second shelf life, and then after that it just kept going on forever. So, you know, yeah, it's Donnie Darko is just one of those things that's, you know, it's an honor to have been a part of that movie, and it's definitely like a great little piece of street cred to throw down whenever anybody's sort of like, you know, questioning whether or not you have any, you know, you belong at the poker table. You can always play Donnie Darko as your trump card. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I definitely can see that. I'm assuming that, you know, you and a young, not really known Seth Rogen and a not very known Gyllenhaal were just on set for this movie that you liked the script and didn't realize that it was going to become as big as it is. And like you said, it was a financial bomb in theaters, but the movie itself resonated with, I'm assuming, mine and your generation. I think you're 5 years difference from me in age, but it's a really unique, weird movie, and it's one of those movies that you can tell someone, like, hey, you want something? Watch something fucking just out there, but awesome. You give them Donnie Darko, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I agree with you. I think you nailed it right there. I mean, it's. It captured the imagination of an entire generation in a lot of ways, and you know, it's really, really cool and rare to be able to be a part of something so awesome. I mean, literally, it's so awesome. Like when we went to back in the day when we went to Comic-Con with the movie. I guess like it was probably like right after the movie had just come out on DVD and stuff. We went to Comic-Con in San Diego before, you know, this is before Comic-Con exploded the way that it is now, and you know, really was hardcore geekdom represented back in those days. It wasn't so like mainstream as it is now. And even then, I remember we had like a panel and we did like a little table there, like sort of announcing that Donnie Darko was going to be coming back out into theaters. And there was like lineups and lineups of people like dressed up in like cosplay as like Frank the Bunny or Donnie or you know, a couple. You know, it was like, what? That's when it really hit us that it was like, whoa, this is something much bigger than even we realized.
And that's when you become literally a part of pop culture, in essence.
Yeah, I guess so. I think, you know, making that movie was definitely an awesome experience as well. And just getting, you know, I mean, getting to put a lot of myself into it as well. Like, a lot of the stuff in that film was, like, you know, ad-libbed and not in the script. And a lot of the jokes and stuff that made it to the final movie, like, were just us joking around on set. And, you know, my character for Halloween, originally in the script, I think I was supposed to be like a clown or something like that for Halloween. And I was like, listen, if this was really me in 1988 going out for Halloween, then I would probably not be a clown. I'd probably be Hulk Hogan. And they were like, all right, well, throw it together and do it. So, like, I literally ran out, like, got, you know, teamed up with the wardrobe and makeup department, and we found a mustache, and we found the blonde wig, and I made the shirt, and we wrote Ronald Mania instead of Hulkamania, and it was so funny. And so, like, when I first came out on the set, like, nobody knew that what the costume was going to be. So I was definitely walking around, like, as the Hulkster, having fun, like, all day. It was so good. And, you know, that type of thing, you know, it's like, that's a small thing, but it's a memorable thing about the movie. It's just like another pop culture type of moment, just to be in that sort of Halloween sequence too. That was just, it's really cool. Really cool.
I'm really happy that you said that, because I rewatched the movie this last week and I hadn't seen it in a while. And I was hoping that since you were a wrestling fan, that was you doing the whole Hulk Hogan thing. So
no,
that was pretty cool. But we'll talk more about the wrestling stuff. I want to transition this. You know, you working on this movie and working on films and doing a lot of voice acting when you were younger. You were part of a show, another big show, at least, you know, for our generation, as far as like just had this huge boom to it with X-Men animated series. You played Proteus and you played young Charles Xavier for a good while. What was it like being a part of that cartoon?
I mean, again, it's like I've just been one of these like really lucky guys to be a part of so many cool projects that have had, you know, have stood the test of time. And, you know, X-Men for sure is one of those. That cartoon is, it's like when I was a kid, G.I. Joe was like the best cartoon ever. And I think like the kids that came after me, X-Men was that for them. And it's so cool to be a part of a show like that. I mean, Donnie Darko, X-Men, The Magic School Bus, you know, these are all sort of projects that are still as popular now as they were, if not more, than when they first came out. So I've been really, really lucky in my career to land some really cool opportunities, and for sure X-Men was one of them.
Yeah, our funny thing is, our first two guests were alumni with the whole entire X-Men animated series franchise. Our first guest that we had on the show a couple of years back was the LaWalds, Julia and Eric, which were awesome, extremely nice. And then we had Cal Dodd on the next episode, Wolverine. So
cool.
That must have been cool to be a kid and be, you know, performing with these characters that are also blowing up in the comic books as well at the same time.
Oh, I mean, listen, I grew up in the baseball card and comic book era where we were obsessed with collecting comic books and baseball cards. I actually made a documentary about the baseball cards, which I'll tell you about later. But the comic books, you know, I would collect them all, buy one copy to read, buy two of them to put in, like, into the sleeve with the hardback. And, you know, I was a diehard collector in X-Men and Avengers and Fantastic Four, like, any kind of crew, like, very... I guess that would explain why I ended up like liking Wu-Tang Clan and other sort of crews later on in life. But I was obsessed with X-Men for sure. And to be, you know, on the show and reading the scripts and seeing like the comic books come to life, it was pretty, it's amazing. It's I don't know. I don't know how I could come up with any other word to explain it other than amazing. It was definitely so cool. I got the spoilers on where the season was going before anybody.
That's so awesome. Oh, man, I love that show. And, yeah, it just being a part of the 90s, you know, with so many animated shows, and must have been a really cool experience. So you basically progressed with voice acting, you know, into acting. We talked about Donnie Darko, and it seems like, you know, you took the role of a producer and also a director with directing recently. You already talked about it a little bit, but you directed a documentary called Jack of All Trades about baseball cards, I believe came out earlier this year. And then
yeah.
You directed two horror films, the Haunted House of Kirby Road, sorry about that, and Scarecrows.
Yeah.
Whichever one you want to cover first, definitely let me know and just dive into it.
Yeah, I mean, the opportunity to direct sort of fell into my lap when, you know, I found out that there were, you know, companies looking to shoot some new horror movies. And, you know, at first I was approached about directing, and I was like, yeah, 100% I want to do that. And they were like, okay, how about this script? And it was like, I don't want to say the name of it, but it wasn't very good. So I was like, listen, if I'm going to take a shot and make something that might not be very good, can I at least make it my own not very good? And they were like, yeah, sure. So we came up with that movie, The Haunted House on Kirby Road, which is basically like a stoner horror movie where a bunch of kids go looking for some trouble. They end up visiting a place that's allegedly a haunted house. They smoke some weed. And shit happens. And we had so much fun. We had so much fun making that movie. Almost too much fun. But the company that we made it for ended up liking it so much. They were like, what else you got? And doing like a multi-film deal with them to do more of these types of horror and genre films. And Scarecrows was the next idea that they loved. So we went for it. And I think from Haunted House on Kirby Road to Scarecrows, if you watch those movies back to back, not that anybody is going to do that, but if they do, you'll see obviously a huge, you can see like lessons learned from the first one carried over into the second one. There's definitely one is so much more of an improvement over the other one, but the characters in the universe are in the same kind of world. And without giving any major spoilers away, there's definitely a connection between the two movies. Like, there's characters and Easter eggs and stuff that show that the Scarecrows movie is sort of a continuation of the world that we created in The Haunted House on Kirby Road. So it's really cool. It's exciting. And the fact that we're working with a company like Breakthrough Entertainment and Uncorked, who support independent film and let us just sort of go out and make the films. And, you know, they sort of are an incubator for, you know, filmmakers to try things, and there's not rules. It's really it's an unbelievable experience to work on these types of films. It's so much fun.
I love horror movies, and I could just tell literally from the trailers for each film, like you were saying, there was definitely a growth. The Haunted House of Kirby Road seemed like a fun, not a slasher, but like a bunch of kids doing something stupid, and you know that all of them, except for probably one, will be dead by the end of this film. The fact that you guys are keeping it within the same shared universe, very much like Blumhouse is doing with the, you know, the Conjuring series and whatnot. Scarecrows, that trailer was really creepy. It gave me a Texas Chainsaw Massacre feel to it, but I loved what you did as far as the filming itself, the graininess of the filming and what you use for, I can't think, of resolutions, you know, to change up. It had almost like, it reminded me of Jeepers Creepers, like that first one. But, yeah, just lots happening in that film. You know, obviously some dude's not really enjoying teenagers, and he's grabbing them and turning them to human scarecrows. Very creepy.
Yeah,
comment.
I mean, it sounds crazy, but that's exactly what the movie is. It's you know, in Kirby Road, the kids were in a haunted house, so it was more like supernatural elements of the house that and we didn't really have like a bad guy, so to speak, like a villain, and that was something that I really wanted to do. And
you know, growing up watching Nightmare on Elm Street and Halloween and Friday the 13th and Puppet Master and all these amazing, you know, it was an amazing golden era for, you know, slasher movies. I wanted to sort of do something in that vein. So we came up with this farmer character and, you know, God forbid you should ever be on his farm because he does not like trespassers. But the movie is still in the same tone. It's still very, there is a lot of laughs in the movie too. It's very, doesn't take itself so seriously, but definitely we amped up the production because when you're shooting in a haunted house, you're like in a house the whole time, and in a cornfield, it's a much more beautiful canvas. You're outdoors. There's a cornfield. There's a sky. There's a whole world out there, and yeah, you can tell. You can see the difference. You know, you can't. Stuff like using a drone, we couldn't do that inside of a house, but in a cornfield, you can. Just stuff like that that just really changed from one film to the other. But again, it's not like you watch Scarecrows, you just make some popcorn. It's not going to hurt your brain to like figure out what's going on, and hopefully you're going to laugh a few times, you're going to scream a few times, and you may even roll your eyes a few times, and that's exactly what we're going for.
Absolutely, and that's such a great trait for, you know, you like classic 80s slasher films, or not necessarily 80s, but, you know, you watch a movie like House of a Thousand Corpses, for instance, which is obviously not 80s, but like Friday the 13th, I think it was part two, something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or the remake of it. You have a bunch of like younger kids going on a journey to have fun, and you know, obviously, that stuff's not going to work out for them like they want. They want to all get laid and just have fun, but something's going to get in the way of that. And I love that just easy kind of setup that's been done a lot in horror movies, but I love it explored more, you know, differently, obviously. And I miss having, you know, in a lot of horror movies, yeah, they have The Nun, and there's different stuff in the Conjuring series, but these icons of horror, it kind of has dwindled, and I appreciate with Scarecrows you went ahead and did that, you know, with the farmer, because, I mean, I was such a fan of this stuff. I recently sold them. I feel bad, but I just didn't have room for them. But I used to collect the Movie Maniacs, and I had from Tarzan, and I had probably the first, I think, five, you know, different groups of them, and I just had them for to the side, and finally I was like, do I really need them? And I made that stupid impulse decision that I regret now, but I love old school horror movies so much. Here's actually a good question. It's kind of related to that. Did you see the new Halloween, and then what did you think about that as, you know, something that was jumping 20 years later, or however many years later, I should say, from the original and erasing all the other ones?
I mean, it was like, it's remarkable. I mean, what Blumhouse has done in overall is remarkable. They've totally turned the entire franchise, not just the franchise of Halloween, but the whole genre on its head over the last, you know, decade. And in the recent years, I mean, with the success of Get Out and now Halloween, it's a whole new ball game for the world of horror, and they should get all the credit in the world for that. And who would have ever thought, you know, that Halloween, you could just do it again and it would work. You know, I remember how Halloween H2O came out and sort of tried to be the sequel that we were all hoping for, and it didn't really deliver. And, you know, this one sort of stands on its own. It's really crazy. And the box office numbers were just mind blowing. Really, really cool. And Michael Myers has always been my favorite of all the bad guys. I mean, I love
Me
Freddy,
too.
Obviously. I love Jason. But Michael Myers, there was something about the strong, silent type. You know, he's the man. And it's really, really, really cool to see that, you know, Halloween did so well. And it's going to open up a lot of doors. I'm sure now we're going to see Nightmare on Elm Street. We're going to see Jason. We're going to see them all come back because, You know, Hollywood has no imagination, and if it worked for Halloween, they're going to be rushing to order. What else can we do? And so that's cool. I'm looking forward to seeing what other monsters start showing up again and being rebooted. I would be shocked if there wasn't a new Freddy Krueger movie. Shocked.
Well, it's funny that you said that because Heather, I think it's Langenkamp, the one who played Nancy, both her and Robert Englund have said love to do basically Wes Craven's Last Nightmare, but not really like outside in the real universe, but like have a final film. And part of me is like, don't do that. But the other part's like, you know, I love the guy from Watchmen who was I forgot the actor's name. I can't think of it for the life of me, but who played Freddy. And it's like anyone besides Robert Englund, I'm sorry, it's going to be very hard for me to take them seriously. It's Freddy Krueger.
It just doesn't. I agree. It's just one of those things. And I got a chance to work with Robert Englund on a film a few years ago, and as an actor. And I was chilling with him, you know, for a good month on set. And every time he talks, it's like Freddy. It's like, you know, it's like hard to picture him not being Freddy. Like, even in the most, you know, he's Freddy. And even without the makeup, he's Freddy. And so I really hope that if they do bring it back, he's involved because, you know, he's what, you know, you could put anybody under the mask to be one of those other types of characters, but Freddie had a real personality and a voice, and there was something that the actor had to bring to the table to make Freddie what he is, right? And, you know, Robert Englund's probably the greatest, you know, horror villain performer of all time. So hopefully with Halloween success, we'll get to see Robert back in wearing the glove and the hat and the sweater again.
Absolutely. I think, you hit the nail right on the head. Michael and Jason, it was good that, you know, Danny McBride, and kudos to, you know, a fellow comedian going into the horror genre and being able to take Halloween back. But they got the original Michael Myers. But I think Robert Englund as Freddy and Brad Dourif as Chucky are the two that are kind of like you need to have those guys involved in it. But apparently LeBron James is going to be redoing Friday 13th, that he loved the films and he wants to make them. It's like I said, being a horror fan, it scares me, but it also excites me at the same time. But we have a lot of fucking reboots, and it gets kind of repetitive, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Friday the 13th is a really interesting one, too, because, you know, if you – basically from, like, Friday the 13th part 2 and on, Jason is, like, the bad guy. You know, if you – like, in the first movie, it's like – no, spoiler, but it's like not – he's not even the killer. In the first one.
Nope, Mama Boys.
And so, you know, to see the evolution, too, it's like Friday the 13th didn't really start catching its groove until part 2 and 3, et cetera. And, it's really just, it's amazing. I think in recent memory, you haven't seen too many, like you said. There hasn't, it's not just with horror movies, it's in general. If you think of like music, even like there's not really like any rock stars anymore. Like, who's the big rock band that could like fill a stadium that's come out in the last 10 years? There isn't one. I don't know why that is, but I feel like it's the same way with movies too. I mean, you just don't see it anymore. Like, I guess Saw has their character, right? That Jigsaw. But, I can't think of any too many others. And as far as like the comedians taking an approach to horror, as you mentioned, you know, also, you know, Jordan Peele did Get Out, another comedian who lent his voice to this genre. And I, you know, I like to consider myself a bit of a comedian as well.
Absolutely.
Coming from the comedy background that I come from. So I think, you know, that tone overall is like a really good approach to these types of movies, I like to think. I mean, if you can make someone laugh, it's a lot easier to scare them because, you know, laughter makes you feel comfortable and happy and at ease. And then it's very easy, you know, to manipulate the audience once you've got them laughing. And I think that's why it's such a great tool to include humor into horror. And for sure, that's part of, you know, both of the films that we've done so far in. The future films that we have coming up, we're pretty much all going to have that type of voice where you can literally, you know, it's not, I'm not making a snuff film. This is not like Eli Roth, you know, torture porn. This is more of a throwback to like Nightmare on Elm Street 3, where, you know, Freddy starts cracking one-liners before he chops people's heads off. It's more like that.
And that's how we want Freddy. you know, just chopping people's heads off and making jokes about it, you know?
I mean, and at that point, people are watching Friday the 13th and Halloween because they're rooting for the bad guys. You know, you're going because of the movie villains. You're going not to see Freddy get killed. You're going to watch Freddy kill people. And that's, you know, if you can create a bad guy like that audiences get behind, you there's no telling how many incarnations you can have of your film. Michael Myers, another example. I mean, Darth Vader is like the greatest bad guy of all time. He's still showing up in the new Star Wars films in some way, shape, or another. Like, they always go back to Darth Vader whenever they can. So I think, you know, everybody loves a good bad guy. You can't have a good hero without a good villain. There's no Batman if there's no Joker. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And, you know, and sometimes, folks, with the two examples he had with the Shape, a.k.a. Michael Myers and Darth Vader, sometimes you don't really need a backstory to make them scary. Anyways.
No, you don't.
I don't even want to go into it because I'm a fan of, specifically with Halloween, Rob's other work in horror, and I love his, you know, his music, but it's kind of like the prequels with, you know, kind of forming Darth Vader. I didn't need it personally. But let's get out of that. I want to talk a little bit more. You were talking about music and comedy and kind of goes into the next subject. You know, you've had a rap career. I think that probably where I would know you from is some of the fun songs that you did with known comedian and actor Jamie Kennedy, your buddy for Celebrity Stalker and Circle, Circle, Dot, Dot. But me researching, I was a real big fan of Ordinary Girl. I liked the message,
oh,
I guess maybe. I've had issues myself with to an extent, but I was able to relate a little bit with the lyrics. But, hey, man, props on you for, you know, regardless, and then the stuff else that I listen to for having good beats and actually rapping. I really appreciate that with anyone.
Thank you. I mean, listen, I get a little embarrassed about that stuff, but I definitely, you know, had a great, you know, anything I'm doing, I'm putting everything into it. And even when we were doing music, you know, it was 110% effort to try to put forth something like better than what people are expecting of you. And I think that, you know, when Jamie and I were doing our MTV show and our record, we were, you know, people were expecting it to be, you know, dog shit. So we wanted to make sure that we went above and beyond and delivered something that blew people's expectations out of the water. And I think we did this song called Rollin' with Bob Saget. And the video is on YouTube. And that really set the table for, you know, a lot of stuff that came after us. You know, Lonely Island and other people who had a lot of success doing, like, comedic type of rap music. But we set the bar pretty high with Bob Saget. And, you know, the album that you're referring to with Ordinary Girl, you know, that was just a chance to sort of, you know, I had the bug, and I just wanted to see what else I could make happen. And it's interesting, even now when, you know, I'm no longer doing that stuff, but for our films, I score the movies. So I'm still doing music, and now I'm just applying it in a John Carpenter kind of way. And getting to score the movies and sourcing out the music from, you know, friends that I made over my years in the music business. And the music is such a huge part of both of the movies that I'm so proud of the music, put it that way. And you can even hear some Stu Stone rap music finds its way onto into the films as well, if you listen closely. But, music was so much fun. It was new. It was exciting. I got a chance to meet every rapper imaginable. And growing up a fan of hip-hop, it was a dream come true to get to chill and meet with, you know, the Wu-Tang Clan and DJ Premier and, you know, Paul Wall and all the big rap stars of the era. We were right there with them. It was so much fun. You have no idea. I can't even begin to tell you.
Yeah, I think that you guys definitely had the Lonely Island Boys thing going before they did. And that's nothing against them, obviously. They had some success. But
no, those are good guys. But I remember like those guys used to open for Jamie on the road, and we used to, you know, they would be like giving us their demos, like, hey, check this out, listen to this, and we were always, you know, it's just awesome that they kind of took. I don't think they took what we did, you know, they didn't copy us or anything like that, 'cause they were doing their thing. But they sort of took what we did, and they did it on a huge level on with the Saturday Night Live platform, and it was really cool to see. You know, Andy Samberg created a whole career out of it. You know, it put him on the map, and he's a good guy. He's a really funny guy, so I'm really happy. I'm really happy for him, obviously. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. Jamie and I always talk about it, like, hey, you know, maybe we were too early. Like when we were doing our MTV show, it was called Blowing Up, and it was sort of like a Curb Your Enthusiasm show for hip-hop. And maybe it was a little ahead of its time because people, like, didn't really understand what it was. They were like, is this real? And, you know, maybe if we would have done it 3 years later, we'd still be doing it right now. You know what I mean? But We reminisce very fondly of that era, and who knows? Maybe we'll get back into the studio one of these days and give the world a sequel they didn't ask for.
Hey man, I would rather listen to a sequel with the two of you guys doing something than any of the little whatever the fucks nowadays in hip hop. I'm an angry hip hop fan, and you know,
I mean, we all are.
So I can kind of just say that just to see, and I mean, it's probably very similar, maybe in aspects to like how people in the 80s like look back on rock of like that evolution, even though obviously I like stuff that went into that. But it's like, you know, when you have an era like the late 60s, early 70s of rock and roll and how pure it was, and then same thing with hip hop, late 80s, early 90s, going into the 2000s, and it just, it's sad, man. I don't even want to get into it. I'm making this depressing. I apologize, but I'm a huge fan of hip hop.
No, me too. And obviously, you know, these days it's more about like how many tattoos do you have on your face, and you know what color is your hair, and how outrageous can you dress, rather than actually being able to like get in the booth and spit actual lyrics. Like you don't actually need to be a rapper to rap anymore.
No, they got the hype guy rapping constantly. I think it was Soulja Boy that kind of caused it, that shift in realizing like, oh wait, and I love Flavor Flav, and he would actually rap with Public Enemy, but that concept of, wait, I can just say something over and over again and make money off of it, and I don't even have to do anything else. Like,
it's unbelievable. It's terrible. But to Flavor Flav's defense, Public Enemy's biggest hit record they ever had, their only top 10 song they ever had, was the one where Flavor Flav does all the rapping. 911 is a joke.
Yep.
So to Flav's credit. But I agree with you 100%. I mean, we grew up in an era of, you know, Notorious B.I.G. and Mobb Deep and Wu-Tang Clan and Gangstar and Tribe Called Quest.
Outkast.
Yeah, and the list goes on and on and on. Goody Mob, and it was just really great.
They just
really
got back together.
Did they really? That's awesome.
They did the tour. Yep.
I'm a huge fan of that whole Dungeon family. So anything they do, I keep my eye on. But I mean, you just don't see it anymore. I mean, even producers like DJ Premier, he has like a signature sound that's like so clearly. You listen to it, and you're like, oh, that's DJ Premier. You don't even get that anymore. Like, all the tracks all sound the same. Everybody's using the same gear and the same plugins and the same drum fills. It's like interchangeable now. It's crazy.
Oh yeah, it's kind of to exit this conversation, but it's like when technology was able to benefit with synthesizers to be able to, you know, people like Stevie Wonder would do that to change sounds to be able to make even more of an array of sounds. And then you get all the way to now, and it's like, well, we'll just have a computer do everything. Fuck it. I mean, we don't even need a real kid anymore. And being a drummer,
I mean,
you don't even need
to be a musician anymore. Like, literally, people are just, like, taking loops and just putting them together. Like, it's become so Fisher-Price. It's so easy to do. And also, there's no – it's like a wild, wild west. You know, there's nobody – there's no labels out there to like curate what's good and what's not. Now everybody just can just record a rap song in their bedroom and put it on SoundCloud that night and hope to go viral. That's like the new school. And you know, the result is pretty cool for the artist because now anybody can just blow up. Anybody can just record a song anywhere. You don't even need a studio, and you can put a song up on SoundCloud and blow up. That's crazy that you're able to do that now. But the bad part about it is that like there's so much more out there now that it's like if you have something really good, you can get lost in a sea of crap. And you know, it's really tough.
People don't want home-cooked meals. They want to go to fucking McDonald's and get a dollar chicken sandwich. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, no, you're right.
Music's the exact same way. It doesn't matter if it's rock. It's like now that corporations have taken it and made it so a certain way with every genre, they'll just grab whoever they want. And it's really discouraging, you know, you being a music fan and a music artist, me being a music fan and also singer, drummer, been in many bands. It sucks that that's what it's come to. But
we sound like every generation, you know, our parents are like, oh, the crap that you guys listen to. It's like now we're at that age where we're like, oh, the crap
what?
That you guys listen to.
Why
would, get off my lawn.
But that's from Boston. Run DMC and why are they with Aerosmith? Like, I remember that when I was a kid.
Oh, that was the best.
You know? Yeah, it was the best.
I mean, listen, an Aerosmith. If you, the crazy thing is that Aerosmith was like left for dead at the time. You know, they were literally dead, and rap music was very like, you know, broken glass everywhere. Oh, ha, ha, ha. It was very like campy at that point. And I think like Run DMC covering an Aerosmith song, it not only put Aerosmith back on the map, it not only put Run DMC on the map, but it sort of put hip hop into like fifth gear and opened up a lot of doors, especially on MTV back then. If you had a video on MTV, you were made men. And after that Run DMC song, you know, it opened the doors for hip hop, LL Cool J, you know, Kool Moe Dee, what do you call it? Eric B and Rakim, Tribe Called Quest. You started seeing so much more. And nowadays, you know, look at the pop charts now. It's all rap. Like, you know, Drake is like the number one selling artist in the history of the world. Hip hop is number one right now, which is crazy. And it's not even because the music isn't even as good as it was, but somehow, you know, hip hop is dominating pop culture, and that is cool. I gotta say that is cool.
Yeah, and I've always been weird about this. To me, rap culture is dominating because I always felt like if someone were to ask me like the difference between hip hop and rap, I would say integrity or more artistry or more like Nas to me is hip hop. You know,
yeah,
someone
for
that.
Sure.
Much more rap, like people can blur the lines. Like Jay-Z he can make a rap hit or he can actually, you know, do some hip hop, but it just depends. But that's always, and I feel like it's the entertainment value. Oh, man, we're going to run on and be like the two old guys complaining in the Muppets if we don't stop with how music is. But let's put this aggression and talk about all of your other passions into a place that I love to kind of like wrap up this interview. With professional wrestling, and it was awesome to find out randomly that you're part of Championship Wrestling from Hollywood. I know that because of Johnny LaQuasto, because I listen to a lot of his podcasts between Xbox 360 and his DC podcast, but that's how I knew it. You got a faction called the Family Stone. Willie Mack's your champion. I'm a huge Willie Mack fan. Tell me a little bit about Championship Wrestling from Hollywood.
Championship Wrestling from Hollywood is another one of those like little engines that could started out on, you know, one TV station locally in Los Angeles, California, and now it's on in over 70 markets and growing every week. It's one of the fastest growing television hours, as Dave Marquez likes to say, and it's really cool. It's unbelievable. From when I first got into wrestling, I always loved wrestling. I grew up being a huge pro wrestling fan, and it's like something that I never grew out of. I just love it. And I was working on a film many years ago a documentary called The Sheik, which was based on Iron Sheik's life. And when I was out doing interviews with wrestlers for the film, I met this guy named Colt Cabana. And Colt and I, we hit it off right away. And he was very interested in starting a podcast. And I was very interested in getting into pro wrestling. So we kind of made a deal where, you know, I would help him launch a podcast. In exchange, he would, like, get me somehow in the door with professional wrestling. And definitely the podcast thing worked out for him. The Art of Wrestling is a staple of podcasts within the wrestling industry, and I'm proud to say that indirectly I'm the godfather of Colt doing that. But he introduced me to a bunch of guys, one of them being David Marquez, who was just starting out championship wrestling from Hollywood at the time. And actually, Johnny LaQuasto and I, we both got hired on the same day. Like, Johnny went to go meet with Dave, and I was waiting outside, and I went into the office, or so to speak, as Johnny was coming out. That was the first time we met, and you know, we both got hired on the same day, and I think we both have never looked back. He has flourished in his role. He started out as an announcer, and now he's a lead play-by-play commentator, and he's a really funny guy, and he loves the sport, obviously. And you know, I got to sort of channel my own Bobby the Brain Heenan type of vibe and become a heel and lead a faction, like a Heenan family type of stable. And a lot of the guys that we were working with have now all gone on to, you know, WWE and beyond. So it's been really cool to be able to see guys that I'm friends with that are, you know, elevating and making big names for themselves and big careers. Willie Mack is a great example. You mentioned Willie. You know, I was around for Willie's beginnings, and when he first won the championship back in Championship Wrestling from Hollywood back in the day, him and Scorpio Sky had a legendary feud and an amazing match where Willie finally got over the hump and won the championship for the first time. And I remember being emotional for Willie. This is a guy that was, you know, practically homeless at the time. He used to take the bus 4 hours, six buses just to get to the wrestling show. And just a guy that busted his ass and had so much athletic ability for somebody that looks like he does. And it's, you know, it's just great to see Willie making a name for himself. He's incredible. And I think his star is just getting started. It's going to just continue to rise. And the next couple of years are going to be huge for Willie. I know he's working with the NWA now. He's the national champion. He won the championship at the 70th anniversary show. So I think, you know, that just shows you what Willie's reputation is for him to be put in a spot like that. And I know he always delivers. So really cool to see Willie shining.
Absolutely. Willie Mack reminds me, and I think as wrestling fans all kind of tend to do this where we just compare to the old guys, but he reminds me of like Junkyard Dog and Dusty Rhodes just combined.
100%. 100%. I mean, Dusty Rhodes. He's what Dusty Rhodes was aiming for. You know, Willie is the real deal. But as an athlete, he does way more than what Dusty had. You know, back then Dusty didn't have to do that stuff because Dusty was such an over the top character and great on the stick that and wrestling back then you didn't need to like do flips and jump off the top rope and stuff like that. Nowadays, wrestling fans are so much more demanding over the performers and what they expect from a wrestler to do in the ring. And, you know, Willie has taken what Dusty's character would have been and added in the arsenal of a cruiserweight or a powerhouse. And, yeah, I mean, you nailed it. If you ask anybody, they're going to say the same thing. Willie is a throwback to Dusty Rhodes. And like I would say, you know, the Junkyard Dog in a lot of ways, too, but he's got that body type that defies, you know, you see him do a standing moonsault. You're like, how the hell did he do that?
Yeah. Him and Keith Lee, man. There's certain wrestlers, him, Keith Lee, Jeff Cobb, they defy gravity sometimes when you're watching them. It's incredible.
Well, Jeff Cobb is another one. He's the real deal. You know, he was a legit amateur wrestler, has a huge pedigree in wrestling. And I, you know, these are the type of guys that you're naming that come through the curtain at Championship Wrestling from Hollywood. You know, we're on a wrestler's path from the independent to the main stages of WWE, they got to come through places like Championship Wrestling from Hollywood. And I think that the thing that makes the Championship Wrestling show so great is that it gives wrestlers who are just used to wrestling, you know, in armories and on independent shows, a chance to sort of experience what TV is going to be like. You know, you don't get that experience in other places where it is such, there is such a focus on the television aspect and the television show aspect more so than anything else. And the training and the experience that you get being in the ring at a Championship Wrestling from Hollywood show totally helps these guys' careers. I mean, Jeff Cobb is a freak athlete. He's unbelievable.
Right.
And now, you know, having him, he would probably tell you himself, you know, being on shows like Championship Wrestling from Hollywood helped him as a performer to know what to do. It's different when you're trying to play for a camera with millions of people watching at home rather than just the, you know, 1,000 people that are in the crowd watching the match. It's a whole different thing. And that's something that Championship Wrestling from Hollywood definitely helped a lot of these guys with. And yeah, I mean, listen, Jeff Cobb is incredible. Brian Cage is another guy who's over 300 pounds and does things that defy logic. You know, there's a lot of them out there now, and I think they're starting to get attention, and it's great to see. I mean, originally, I would say the best I ever saw, we had, at one point, we had Austin Aries and Scorpio Sky and Cesaro. Claudio was on, the three of those guys were working sort of an angle together, and it was just a treat. And Willie Mack, I believe, was involved in that storyline too, if I'm not mistaken. But just to see the matches that these guys were having, it was like you knew that this was special. And all of those guys that I just mentioned are all unbelievable performers. You know, Cesaro might be one of the best. People don't realize it,
yep.
But the guy's so good. But you could tell back then that how good they were. They were just naturals.
Yeah, I always say Cesaro reminds me, and I think he'll have a similar, which is not a bad career at all, but like Davey Boy Smith was to his generation of being this huge, great jacked wrestler, but his strength was awesome and his agility was amazing too. I would love to go further. I don't even want to talk about WWE. It's kind of like talking about modern hip hop sometimes. Like it's just like a love-hate relationship. Because if honestly, and I hate saying this, but if I didn't have to watch Raw to cover it for my my wrestling podcast, I probably wouldn't watch it. I love SmackDown. I love NXT. I love MLW. I've watched you guys from time to time. Love Lucha Underground. I watch Impact once in a while. But Vince McMahon very much, probably to you too, is like a Walt Disney for my generation. But I feel
for sure
that he's getting a little bit out of touch. And I'm looking forward to seeing SmackDown move to ESPN to be more sports-driven, like they're saying. Because I know that Vince is not as hands-on. Of course, he's a final decision, but Road Dogg and Triple H kind of mainly go over, you know, the booking and stuff like that. I just don't like the micromanaging, and I really hate the scripted promos. I can't stand that shit.
Yeah, well, I the scripted promos part for sure. I think at some point probably they lost trust in some of the performers and sort of maybe felt like they had to do that. But listen, to Vince's credit, to counter – not that he needs me to come to his aid, but to counterpoint what you just said, which you're not wrong in what you're saying. But, you know, if you ask Radiohead to do a show every single week, 3 hours, eventually, you know, you're going to get more misses than hits. Like even the greatest genius of all time isn't going to be perfect every single time. And if you think about the longevity of how long Vince has been a storyteller for, and how many hours of television they're filling every week for the last 30 years. You know, there's only so many different ways you can tell that story, and eventually, you know, you're going to get to a place where you're at. You know, even the greatest painter in the world isn't, at some point, their paintings are not going to be as good as the ones before. You know what I mean? So, listen, I think that sometimes they get it right, and when they do, it's amazing. I think the WrestleMania, the one when the Hardy Boys came back, that was so awesome.
Crazy.
That was you know, that was like a huge mark out moment that for everybody. And,
yeah.
You know, so sometimes those magical moments still do exist. But yeah, it's hard. It would be hard for anybody. It would be hard for The Walking Dead to do 52 episodes a year, 3 hours long, and then another 52 episodes a year, 2 hours long, and a pay-per-view. Like, eventually you would be saying the same thing about anybody. So that's the only – that's how I'm going to come to Vince's defense, that he's been doing it for so long. But listen, the NXT stuff is so fun to watch. The action is can't miss. You can tell that the guys and girls on the show, especially on those takeover pay-per-views, are really going for it, trying to show the boss that they're worthy of the call-up. And as a result, you're seeing unbelievable matches. The NXT stuff is really exciting.
Yeah, NXT is almost at the level of at least containing it more sportsmanlike, like New Japan does. Than a lot of other, than at least Raw and SmackDown. Well, Raw mainly. I don't know. You've definitely, Stuart Stone over here, guys, you know, talking me off the ledge. I just, you know, watching this every week, time to time, I get a little bit annoyed, but I'm also someone that comes to Vince's, you know, defense a lot of times myself, too, when people are a little bit too ridiculous with their claims and everything. We're going at a time in wrestling where it's all exposed. Everyone knows entertainment form. There's nothing else besides that. And Vince has built this form of wrestling with WWF, you know, in the 80s of a certain style and a certain, you know, in style itself too, just telling stories, their version of psychology. That's different than before previous with the NWA, the Crockett's, all that stuff, and is different than a lot of the other. What I love about wrestling is that, you know, to kind of like wrap things up with this, is that you can find good wrestling in any form. There's so many different things. I watched Triple Mania, and that was so different than All In, and that was so different than,
you
know.
That All In show was so good.
Oh, it was awesome. It was so dope.
Yeah. No, I loved it. I mean, you're 100% right. But, you know, at the same time with wrestling fans, we're
fickle.
Sadists in a lot of ways too, though. We like the self-punishment because, you know, wrestling fans are a lot like Star Trek fans. Like, we'll watch anything wrestling. We'll watch bad wrestling. We'll watch good wrestling. We'll watch any wrestling. And it's like Star Trek fans will watch any Star Trek, good Star Trek, bad Star Trek. They love Star Trek. I think in a lot of ways there's a fair comparison there. But, you know, I have the WWE Network and I find myself like watching old WCW pay-per-views that were probably terrible at the time, but now I love them. You know, you never know. You may look back at this era and find that you ended up liking it. But listen, people shit all over, you know, how they have Brock Lesnar, you know, in the top spot. But, you know, Brock Lesnar is he's the man. I mean, in real life, Brock Lesnar would beat the shit out of anybody. And his style, I guess it's, you know, maybe it's getting staler now, but I mean, his comeback and his matches that he had with Cena, and it's incredible. Like, he looked like he killed Cena. There was like the match where he beat the shit out of him. It was unbelievable. And I just like his style. I think that he works, you know, now they're working in a way sort of to protect him because he's obviously got a UFC fight coming up. But when he goes 20 minutes or 15 minutes, it's always a good match. I haven't seen a bad one.
No, and he's legitimate. I think that's the biggest thing is that, you know, you look at Brock Lesnar, this is someone that has championship ranks in legitimate, you know, MMA with UFC, and also before that with wrestling and NCAA. And then he's also had accolades of being the IWGP champion. He's been how many times a Universal champion, the WWF champion, and the World Heavyweight, which has lineage with the NWA. I mean, he's a very decorated – he's basically Vince's version. He's very much a heel version of this. Vince's version of how Vince Sr. looked at Bruno Sammartino in his later years.
Yeah, for
he's
sure.
He's an attractive –
yeah.
He has physical presence, and he doesn't have to say much. Just get in that ring and, you know, make basically them the promoter money. But I feel like I've held you up for a very long time, man, and I want to wrap this up, but I want to say this has been one of my favorite interviews I've had in a very long time, And I have a podcast that's a part of Geek Vibes Nation and everything that we do called Wrestling Geeks Alliance, that if you're ever free, maybe we can talk to, you know, whoever we have to, your publicist or whoever, and maybe get you on that show either to talk more specifically about this thing, or we can have you just co-host. I would love that too. But Stuart, it's been great talking to you, man. You are, like I said, you are up there for Renaissance Man with Dean Cain, as far as people have interviewed. And if you don't know that reference, that guy went preferred football player. You know, it's craziness. When I was like, what, Superman? I didn't even know he was part Japanese.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
Either
way.
God bless him. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the love. And if people can look out for Scarecrows, it's coming out December 11th. And definitely check it out. And if you want to follow along with my journey, I'm on all the social media platforms under Stu Stone, Stustone. And you can check out, you know, what's next for us. Movie-wise, the Jack of All Trades movie is going to come out in the States also early next year. So there's some cool stuff to coming out. So thanks for having me, and best of luck to you with everything. And hopefully we'll get to talk wrestling on your other show very soon.
Absolutely, Stu. Thank you so much for being on, and have a wonderful evening.
You too, man. Take care.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was the amazing Stuart Stone. Really had a fun time talking to this guy. Obviously, we've been rambling for over an hour, but I mean, like his documentary about baseball cards kind of represents who he is. He's a jack of all trades. I mean, he's been a part of animation that I watched. He was part of a movie that I watched in high school that spoke to me in a very weird way, but still spoke to me nonetheless. You know, and he's a lover of professional wrestling and horror movies. So had a great time geeking out with him. Definitely going to have him on Wrestling Geeks Alliance. You guys just wait around to find out more information about that. Hope you guys enjoyed the interview as always. And if you want to, you know, and unless you already have, and then do it more. But if you want to, check out our wonderful website at gvnation.com. That's GV as in Geek Vibes Nation.com. That has all of our news from our wonderful writing staff, all the updates for what we're doing, as well as, you know, all the audio stuff for iTunes and Blog Talk for our shows, like Wrestling Geeks Alliance, which is on Wednesday nights, like I said, and Geek Vibes Live, our Sunday night show, as well as many other shows, Full Court Press, the Top 10 Show, et cetera, et cetera. All on Blog Talk, all on iTunes. Check that out. And then a link to all of our social medias at Facebook, at Instagram, at Twitter. Join us. Join the conversation. Take over this world with Geek Vibes Nation. You guys have a good one out there. Peace out. And let the Geek Vibes be with you.